Chapter 46. Beyond the Gate. Perrin paid scant attention as Rand instructed a maiden. Tell Sulin to prepare rooms for Perrin and Fail, and obey them as she would me. The two Aiel women took that as some sort of great joke, from the way they laughed and slapped thighs, but Perrin was staring at a slender man, standing a little way down the tapestry-hung corridor. He had no doubt at all that the man was Davram Bashir. It was not just that he was Saldaean, and he surely looked nothing like Fail with those thick, gray-streaked mustaches curving down to almost hide his mouth. He was no taller than Fail either, maybe a little shorter. But the way he stood, arms folded, face like a hawk staring down into a henyard, made Perrin certain. The man knew. That was certain, too. Making last goodbyes to Rand, Perrin took a deep breath and walked up the hallway. He found himself wishing he had his axe. Bashir was wearing his sword. "Lord Bashir?" Perrin made a bow that was not returned. The man reeked of cold fury. "I am Perrin Ebarra."
"We will talk,"
Bashir said curtly and turned on his heel. Perrin had no choice but to follow, and to take quick strides despite his longer legs. Two turnings later, Bashir entered a small sitting room and closed the door behind them. Tall windows let in plenty of light, and even more heat than the high ceiling could handle. Two chairs with padded seats and high, scroll-carved backs had been placed facing each other. A silver pitcher with a tall neck and two silver cups stood on a lapis-inlaid table. Not punch this time. Strong wine, by the smell. Bashir filled the cups and thrust one at Perrin, gesturing peremptorily to one of the chairs. He wore a smile behind his mustaches, but eyes and smile could have belonged to two different men. The eyes could have driven nails.
"I suppose Zareen told you all about my estates before you married her. All about the broken crown. She was always talkative as a girl."
The man remained standing, so Perrin did as well. Broken crown? Fail had certainly never mentioned any broken crown. "First she told me you were a fur trader, or maybe it was a lumber merchant first, and then a fur trader. You sold ice peppers, too." Bashir gave a start, repeating,
"Fur trader?"
incredulously under his breath. "Her story changed," Perrin went on. "But once too often she repeated something you had said about how a general should behave. And I asked her straight out, and—" He peered into his wine, then made himself meet the other man's eyes. "When I found out who you were, I almost changed my mind about marrying her. Only she had her mind set, and when Fail has her mind set, shifting her is like shifting a hitch of mules that have all decided to sit down at once. Besides, I loved her. I love her."
"Fail?" Bashir barked. "Who in the pit of doom is this Fail? We are talking about my daughter Zareen, and what you've done to her."
"Fail is the name she took when she became a hunter for the horn," Perrin said patiently. He had to make a good impression on this man. Being at odds with your father-in-law was almost as bad as being at odds with your mother-in-law. "That was before she met me."
"A hunter?"
Pride shone in the man's voice and his sudden grin. The scent of anger almost vanished.
"The little minx never said a word to me about that. I must say Fail suits her better than Zareen. That was her mother's notion, and I—"
Suddenly he gave himself a shake, and Perrin a suspicious stare. Anger began scenting the air again.
"Don't try changing the subject, boy. What we are about is you and my daughter and this supposed marriage of yours."
"Supposed?" Perrin had always been good at holding his temper. Mr. Sluhan said he never had one. When you were bigger and stronger than the other boys growing up and might hurt somebody by accident, you learned to hold your temper. Right then he was having a little difficulty, though. "The Wisdom performed the ceremony, the same as everybody's been married in the Two Rivers since time out of mind."
"Boy, it wouldn't matter if you had the words said by an Ogier elder with six Aes Sedai standing witness. Zareen still isn't old enough to marry without her mother's permission, which she never asked, much less received. She is with Dira right now. And if she doesn't convince her mother she's old enough to be married, she goes back to the camp, probably doing duty as her mother's saddle. And you..."
Bashir's fingers stroked the hilt of his sword, though he did not seem aware of it.
"You," he said in an almost jolly tone, "I get to kill."
"Fael is mine," Perrin growled.
Wine slopped over his wrist, and he looked down in surprise at the wine cup crushed in his fist. He set the twisted piece of silver on the table carefully, beside the pitcher, but he could do nothing about his voice.
"Nobody can take her from me. Nobody! You take her back to your camp, or anywhere, and I'll come for her."
"I have 9,000 men with me," the other man said in a surprisingly mild tone. "Are they harder to kill than Trollocs?"
"Try taking her! Try! And we'll find out!"
He was shaking, Perrin realized, his hands clenched into fists so hard they hurt. It shocked him. He had not been angry, really angry, in so long that he no longer remembered what it was like. Bashir studied him up and down and then shook his head.
"It might be a shame to kill you. We need some new blood. It's getting thin in the house. My grandfather used to say we were all becoming soft, and he was right. I'm half the man he was, and much as it shames me to say it, Zareen is terribly soft. Not weak, mind."
He frowned hard for a moment, nodding when he saw Perrin was not going to say Fael was weak.
"But soft, just the same."
And that shocked Perrin so, he sat down before he realized he had moved to the chair. He almost forgot to be angry. Was this man mad, changing about like that? And Fael, soft? She could be deliciously soft at times, true, but any man who thought she was soft, in the way her father meant, would probably have his head handed to him, himself included. Bashir picked up the crushed wine cup, studied it, then replaced it, and took the other chair.
"Zareen told me a good bit about you before she went with her mother. All about Lord Perrin of the Two Rivers, Slayer of Trollocs. That's good, that. I like a man who can stand toe-to-toe with a Trolloc and not back up. Now I want to know what kind of man you are."
He waited expectantly, sipping his wine. Perrin wished he had some more of Rand's melon punch or even his wine cup undented. His throat had gone dry. He wanted to make that good impression, but he had to start with the truth.
"The fact of it is, I am not really a lord. I'm a blacksmith. You see, when the Trollocs came..."
He trailed off because Bashir was laughing so hard the man had to wipe his eyes.
"Boy, the Creator never made the houses. Some forget it. But go far enough back in any house and you'll find a commoner who showed uncommon courage or kept his head and took charge when everybody else was running around like plucked geese. Mind you, another thing some like to forget is the road down can be just as sudden. I've two maids in Tyre, who would be ladies if their forebears, 200 years ago, hadn't been fools even a fool wouldn't follow. And a woodcutter in Sedona who claims his ancestors were kings and queens before Otter Hawkwing. He might be telling the truth. He's a good woodcutter. As many roads down as up, and the roads down as slippery as the others."
Bashir snorted hard enough to make his mustaches stir.
"A fool moans when fortune takes him down, and it takes a true fool to moan when fortune takes him up. What I want to know about you isn't what you were, or even so much what you are, as what you are inside. If my wife leaves Zareen with a whole hide and I don't kill you, Do you know how to treat a wife? Well?
Mindful of that good impression, Perrin decided not to explain that he would much rather be a blacksmith again.
I treat Fahil as well as I know how, he said carefully.
Bashir snorted again.
As well as you know how.
His flat tone became a growl.
You had better know well enough, boy, or I'll... You hear me? A wife isn't a trooper to go running when you shout. In some ways, a wife is like a dove. You hold her half as hard as you think is necessary, or you might hurt her.
You don't want to hurt, Zareen. You understand me?
He grinned suddenly, disconcertingly, and his voice grew almost friendly.
You might do very well for a son-in-law, Ibarra. But if you make her unhappy...
He was stroking his sword hilt again.
I try to make her happy, Perrin said seriously. Hurting her is the last thing I'd want to do.
Good. Because it will be the last thing you do, boy.
That was delivered with a grin, too, but Perrin had no doubts Bashir meant every word.
I think it's time to take you to Deera. If she and Zareen haven't finished their discussion by now, best we step in before one of them kills the other. They always did get a little carried away when they argued, and Zareen's too big now for Deera to put an end to it by spanking her.
Bashir put his cup on the table and went on as they started for the door.
One thing you have to be aware of, just because a woman says she believes something doesn't mean it's true. Oh, she'll believe it, but a thing is not necessarily true just because a woman believes it is. You keep that in mind.
I will.
Perrin thought he understood what the man meant. Fahil sometimes had only a passing acquaintance with the truth. Never about anything important, or at least not what she considered important. But if she promised to do something she did not want to do, she always managed to leave herself a hole to wriggle through and keep the letter of the promise while doing exactly as she wished. What he did not understand was what that could have to do with meeting Fahil's mother. It was a long walk through the palace, along colonnades and up flights of stairs. There did not seem to be many Saldaeans about, but a good many Aielmen and maidens, not to mention red and white liveried servants who bowed and curtsied, and white-robed men and women like those who had taken the horses. Those last scurried along with trays or armloads of toweling, eyes down, and seemed to take no notice of anyone. With a start, Perrin realized that a number of them wore the same length of scarlet cloth around their temples that many of the Aielmen did. They must be Aiel, too. He noticed a small thing as well. As many women as men in the white robes wore the headband, and men in the drab coats and breeches, but no maidens that he saw. Gaul had told him a little about the Aiel, but he had never mentioned the headbands. As he and Bashir entered a room with ivory-inlaid chairs and small tables set on a patterned carpet of red and gold and green, Perrin's ears picked up the muffled sound of women's voices raised in an inner room. He could not make out words through the thick door, but he could tell that one of them was Fahil. Abruptly, there was a slap, followed almost immediately by another, and he winced. Only a complete woolhead stepped between his wife and her mother when they were arguing. By what he had seen, usually they both rounded on the poor fool. And he knew very well that Fahil could stand up for herself in normal circumstances. But then again, he had seen strong women, themselves mothers and even grandmothers, allow themselves to be treated like children by their own mothers. Squaring his shoulders, he strode for the inner door, but Bashir was there before, rapping his knuckles as if they had all the time in the world. Of course, Bashir could not hear what sounded to Perrin like two cats in a sack. Wet cats. Bashir's rap cut off the snarling as though with a knife.
"You may come,"
a composed voice said loudly. It was all Perrin could do not to push past Bashir, and once he was inside, his eyes sought out Fahil anxiously, where she sat in a wide-armed chair just where the light from the windows became less sharp. The carpet was mostly dark red in here, making him think of blood, and one of the two wall hangings showed a woman on horseback killing a leopard with a spear. The other was a furious battle swirling around a white lion banner. Her scent was a jumble of emotions he could not separate, and her left cheek bore a red handprint. But she smiled at him, if faintly. Fail's mother made Perrin blink. With all Bashir's talk of doves, he expected a fragile woman. But Lady Dira stood inches taller than her husband, and she was statuesque. Not big like Mistress Luhan, who was round, or like Daze Conger, who looked as if she could take over a blacksmith's hammer. She was buxom, which a man certainly should not think of in his mother-in-law, and he could see where Fail got her beauty. Fail's face was her mother's face, without the slash of white through her dark hair on her temples. If that was how Fail would look when she reached that age, he was a very fortunate man. On the other hand, that bold nose gave Lady Dira the look of an eagle, as those dark, tilted eyes fastened on him. A fiery-eyed eagle, ready to sink talons deep into a particularly insolent rabbit. She smelled of fury and contempt. The real surprise, though, was the crimson handprint on her cheek. "Father, we were just talking of you," Fail said with an affectionate smile, gliding to him and taking his hands. She kissed his cheeks, and Perrin felt a sudden stab of disgruntlement. A father did not deserve all that, when there was a husband standing right there with only one brief smile to sustain him.
"Should I ride away and hide then, Zareen?" Bashir chuckled.
Oh, a very rich chuckle. The man did not even seem to see that his wife and daughter had hit each other.
"She prefers Fail, Davram," Lady Dira said absently.
Arms folded beneath that ample bosom, she eyed Perrin up and down without any effort to disguise it. He heard Fail whisper softly to her father,
"It depends on him now."
Perrin supposed it did, if she and her mother had come to blows. Squaring his shoulders, he prepared to tell Lady Dira that he would be as gentle with Fail as if she were a kitten, that he himself would be meek as a lamb. The last part would be a lie, of course. Fail would spit a meek man and roast him for dinner, but peace had to be maintained. Besides, he did try to be gentle with her. Maybe the Lady Dira was why Bashir talked so about gentleness. No man would have the nerve to be anything else with this woman. Before he could open his mouth, Fail's mother said,
"Yellow eyes do not make a wolf. Are you strong enough to handle my daughter, young man? From what she tells me, you're a milksop, indulging her every whim, letting her twine you around her fingers whenever she wants to play cat's cradle."
Perrin stared. Bashir had taken the chair Fail had been sitting in, and now he was complacently studying his boots, one propped atop the toe of the other. Fail, seated on the broad arm of her father's chair, gave her mother one indignant frown, then smiled at Perrin with all the confidence she had shown when telling him to stand up to Rand.
"I don't think she twists me around her finger," he said carefully.
She tried, true, but he did not think he had ever let her, except once in a while, to please her. Lady Dira's sniff spoke volumes.
"Weaklings never think so. A woman wants a strong man. Stronger than she. Here."
Her finger poked his chest hard enough to make him grunt.
"I'll never forget the first time Davram took me by the scruff of the neck and showed me he was the stronger of us. It was magnificent."
Perrin blinked. That was an image his mind could not hold.
"If a woman is stronger than her husband, she comes to despise him. She has the choice of either tyrannizing him or else making herself less in order not to make him less. If the husband is strong enough, though," she poked him again, even harder, "she can be as strong as she is, as strong as she can grow to be. You will have to prove to Fail that you're strong."
Another poke, harder still.
"The women of my family are leopards.
If you cannot train her to hunt on your command, Fael will rake you as you deserve. Are you strong enough? This time her finger drove Perrin back a step.
Will you stop that? He growled.
He refrained from rubbing his chest. Fael was giving no help at all, merely smiling at him encouragingly. Bashir was studying him with pursed lips and a cocked eyebrow.
If I indulge her sometimes, it's because I want to. I like to see her smile. If you expect me to trample on her, you can forget it.
Maybe he had lost with that. Fael's mother began staring at him in a most peculiar way, and her scent was a tangle he could not make out, though anger was still in it, and icy disdain. But good impression or no, he was done with trying to say what Bashir and his wife wanted to hear.
I love her, and she loves me, and that's the whole of it, as far as I'm concerned.
He says, Bashir said slowly, that if you take our daughter away, he will take her back. He seems to think 9,000 Saldaean horse no match for a few hundred Two Rivers bowmen.
His wife gazed at Perrin consideringly, then visibly took herself in hand, her head coming erect.
That is all very well, but any man can swing a sword. What I want to know is whether he can tame a willful, headstrong, disobedient—
Enough, dearer, Bashir cut in mildly. Since you've obviously decided Zareen Fael is no longer a child, I think Perrin will do well enough.
To Perrin's surprise, Bashir's wife bowed her head meekly.
As you say, my heart.
Then she glared at Perrin, not meekly at all, as if to say that was the way a man should handle a woman. Bashir murmured something under his breath about grandchildren and making the blood strong again. And Fael? She smiled at Perrin with an expression he had never seen on her face before, an expression that made him decidedly uncomfortable. With her hands folded and her ankles crossed and her head tilted to one side, she somehow managed to look submissive.
Fael?
Maybe he had married into a family where everyone was mad. Closing the door on Perrin, Rand finished his goblet of punch, then sprawled in a chair, thinking. He hoped Perrin got on well with Bashir, but then if they struck sparks, maybe Perrin would be more amenable to Tyr. He needed either Perrin or Matt there to convince Samael that that was the true attack. The thought brought a soft, bitter laugh. Light, what a way to think about a friend. Luz Theron was giggling and muttering indistinctly about friends and betrayal. Rand wished he could sleep for a year. Min entered without knocking or being announced, of course. The maidens sometimes looked at her oddly, but whatever Sulin had said, or maybe Malayne, Min was now on the short list of those sent on in, whatever he was doing. She took advantage, too. Once already she had insisted on taking a stool beside his bathtub and talking as if nothing were out of the ordinary at all. Now she just paused to fill herself a goblet of punch and dropped into his lap with a little bounce. A faint sheen of sweat glistened on her face. She would not even try to learn how to ignore the heat, just laughing and saying she was not Aes Sedai and had no plans to be. He had become her favorite chair for these visits, it seemed, but he was certain if he merely pretended not to notice, she would give up her game sooner or later. That was why he had hid as best he could in his bathwater instead of blindfolding her with air. Once she knew she was affecting him, she would never stop the joke. Besides, much as it shamed him to admit it about Min, having a girl on his knees did feel nice. He was not made of wood.
Did you have a good talk with Fael?
It didn't last long. Her father came and got her, and she was too busy flinging arms around his neck to notice me. I went for a little walk after.
You didn't like her, he said,
and Min's eyes widened, her lashes making them look even larger. Women never expected a man to see or understand anything they did not want him to.
It isn't that I dislike her, exactly, she said, drawing the words out. It's just... Well, she wants what she wants when she wants it, and she will not take no for an answer. I pity poor Perrin married to her. Do you know what she wanted with me? To make sure I had no designs on her precious husband. You may not have noticed. Men never see these things. She cut off, looking up at him suspiciously through those long lashes. He had showed he could see some things, after all. Once she was satisfied he did not mean to laugh or bring it up, she went on. I could see at a glance he's besotted with her, the poor fool, and she with him, for all the good it will do him. I don't think he would even look twice at another woman, but she doesn't believe it. Not if the other woman looks first, anyway. He's found his falcon, and I wouldn't be surprised if she kills him when the hawk appears. Her breath caught, and she glanced up at him again, then busied herself drinking from the goblet. She would tell him what she meant if he asked. He remembered her as saying nothing of her viewings, unless they concerned him. But if that was so, she had changed for some reason. She would view anyone he asked now, and tell him everything she saw. Yet doing so made her uncomfortable.
"Shut up," he shouted at Luce Theron. "Go away, you're dead."
It had no effect. It often did not, now. That voice went on mumbling, maybe about being betrayed by friends, maybe about betraying them. "Did you see anything that concerns me?" he asked. With a grateful grin, Min settled companionably against his chest. Well, she probably meant it to be companionable. Or then again, very likely not. And began talking between sips of punch. "When you two were together, I saw those fireflies and the darkness stronger than ever. I like melon punch. But with the two of you in the same room... The fireflies were holding their own instead of being eaten faster than they can swarm, the way they do when you're alone. And something else I saw when you were together. Twice he's going to have to be there, or you..." She peered into her goblet so he could not see her face. "If he's not, something bad will happen to you." Her voice sounded small and frightened. "Very bad."
Much as he would have liked to know more, like when and where and what, she would have told him already had she known.
"Then I'll just have to keep him around," he said, as cheerfully as he could. He did not like for Min to be frightened. "I don't know that that will be enough," she mumbled into her punch. "It will happen if he is not there, but nothing I saw said it won't because he is. It will be very bad, Rand. Just thinking of that viewing makes me..."
He turned her face up and was surprised to see tears leaking from her eyes.
"Min, I didn't know these viewings could hurt you," he said gently. "I'm sorry."
"A flat lot, you know, sheepherder," she muttered.
Plucking a lace-edged handkerchief from her sleeve, she dabbed at her eyes.
"It was just dust. You don't make Sewell and Dustin here often enough."
The handkerchief went back with a flourish.
"I should go back to the Crown of Roses. I just had to tell you what I saw about Perrin."
"Min, be careful. Maybe you shouldn't come so often. I can't think Mirana would be easy on you if she discovered what you are doing."
Her grin looked very much her old self, and her eyes looked amused, even if they did still shine from the tears.
"You let me worry about me, sheepherder. You think I am gawking at the sights of Camelin like every other country simpleton? If I didn't come every day, would you know they are meeting with the nobles?"
She had glimpsed that by chance on her way to the palace yesterday, Mirana appearing for an instant at the window of a palace Min had learned belonged to Lord Pellavar. There was as much chance that Pellavar and his guests were the only ones as there was that Mirana had gone to clear Pellavar's drains.
"You be careful," he told her firmly. "I don't want you hurt, Min."
For a moment she studied him silently, then rose up enough to kiss him lightly on the lips. At least, well,
It was light, but this was a daily ritual when she left, and he thought maybe those kisses were getting a little less light every day. Despite all his promises to himself, he said, "I wish you wouldn't do that." Letting her sit on his knee was one thing, but kisses were carrying the joke too far.
"No tears yet, farm boy?" she smiled. "No stammer?"
Ruffling his hair as if he were 10, she walked to the door. But as she sometimes did, she moved in a gracefully swaying fashion that might not have produced tears and stammer, but certainly did make him stare, however hard he tried not to. His eyes whipped to her face as she turned around.
"Why, sheep herder, your face is flushed. I thought the heat never touched you now. Never mind. I wanted to tell you I will be careful. I'll see you tomorrow. Be sure to put on clean stockings."
Rand let out a long breath once the door was firmly shut behind her.
Clean stockings?
He put on clean every day. There were only two choices. He could keep pretending she was having no effect until she quit, or he could resign himself to stammering. Or maybe to begging. She might stop if he begged, but then she would have that to tease him with. And men did like teasing. The only other option, keeping their time together short, being cold and distant, was out of the question. She was a friend. He could as well have been cold toward Avienda and Elaine were the names that came to mind, and they did not fit. Toward Matter Perrin. The only thing he did not understand was why he still felt so comfortable around her. He should not, with her taunting him in this way, but he did. Luz Theron's maundering had grown louder from the moment the Aes Sedai were mentioned, and now he said quite clearly,
"If they are plotting with the nobles, I have to do something about them."
"Go away," Rand commanded.
"Nine are too dangerous, even untrained. Too dangerous. Can't allow them. No, oh no."
"Go away, Luz Theron."
"I am not dead,"
the voice howled.
"I deserve death, but I am alive, alive, alive."
"You are dead," Rand shouted back in his head. "You are dead, Luz Theron."
The voice dwindled, still howling alive when it faded from hearing. Shaking, Rand got up and refilled his goblet, draining the punch in one long swallow. Sweat dripped from his face, and his shirt clung to him. Finding the concentration again was an effort. Luz Theron was growing more persistent. One thing was certain. If Mirana was plotting with the nobles, especially the nobles ready to declare rebellion if he did not produce Elaine soon enough to satisfy them, then he did have to do something. Unfortunately, he had no idea what.
"Kill them," Luz Theron whispered. "Nine are too dangerous, but if I kill some, if I chase them away, kill them, make them fear me, I will not die again."
"I deserve death, but I want to live."
He began to weep, but the whispered rambling continued. Rand filled his goblet again and tried not to listen.
When the Oregon gate into the inner city came into sight, Demira Arif slowed. A number of men in the crowded street eyed her admiringly as they squeezed past, and for perhaps the thousandth time she made a note to stop wearing dresses from her native Arad Doman, and for the thousandth time promptly forgot it. Dresses were hardly important. She had been having the same six duplicated for years, and if a man who did not realize she was Aes Sedai became too impudent, it was always a simple matter to let him know who he was being saucy to. That got them out of her hair quickly enough, usually as fast as they could run. Right then, all she was interested in was the Oregon Gate, a great white marble arch in the gleaming white wall, the stream of people, carts, and wagons passing through it watched by a dozen Aiel men she suspected were not so desultory as they appeared at first glance. They might recognize an Aes Sedai on sight. Surprising people did sometimes. Besides, she had been followed from the Crown of Roses. Those coats and breeches made to fade into rock and brush stood out on a city street. So even had she wanted to enter the inner city, even had she been willing to risk Mirana's wrath, by entering without first asking Althor's permission, she would not have. How that did gall, Aes Sedai being required to ask a man's permission. All she wanted was a sight of one Milam Harnder, second librarian in the royal palace, and her agent for nearly 30 years. The library in the palace here could not compare with that in the White Tower, or the royal library in Cairhien, or the Tirhana library in Bandar Aban, but she might as well wish to fly as for access to one of those. Still, if her message had reached Milam, he would have begun searching for the books she wanted. The palace library might well have some information about the seals on the Dark One's prison, perhaps even catalogued sources, though that might be too much to hope. Most libraries had volumes lying in corners that should have been recorded long ago, yet somehow had remained forgotten for 100 years, or 500, sometimes even more. Most libraries held treasures even the librarians did not suspect. She waited patiently, letting the crowd flow by her, attending only to the people coming out of the gate, but she did not see Milam's bald head and round face. At last she sighed. Plainly he had not received her message. If he had, he would have made whatever excuse was necessary to be there at the appointed time. She was going to have to wait on her turn to accompany Mirana to the palace, and hope young Althor would give her permission again, to search in the library. Turning away from the gate, her eyes chanced to meet those of a tall, lean-faced fellow in a carter's vest who was gazing at her much too admiringly. When their eyes met, he winked. She was not going to put up with that all the way back to the inn. I really must remember to have some plain dresses made, she thought, wondering why she had never done it before. Luckily she had been in Camelin before, some years ago, and Stefan would be waiting at the Crown of Roses, a beacon she could use to guide her if it came to that. She slipped into the narrow shaded gap between a cutler's shop and a tavern. The narrow alleyways of Camelin had been muddy the last time she was in them, but even dry, the deeper she went, the more unfortunate the smell. The walls were blank, with never a window and seldom a cramped door or narrow gate, and those with the look of not having been open in a long time. Scrawny cats peered at her silently from atop barrels and back walls, and stray dogs with knobby ribs laid back their ears, sometimes growling before they skulked off down a crossing run, as alleys were called here. She felt no worry about being scratched or bitten. Cats seemed to sense something about Aes Sedai. She had never heard of an Aes Sedai being scratched by even the most feral cat. Dogs were hostile, true, almost as if they thought Aes Sedai were cats, but they almost always slinked away after a little show. There were far more dogs and cats in the runs than she remembered, and gaunter, but many fewer people. She had not seen anyone at all before she rounded a corner to find 5 or 6 Aiel men coming toward her, laughing and talking among themselves. They seemed startled to see her. "Pardon, Aes Sedai," one of them muttered, and they all pressed against the side of the run, though there was plenty of room. Wondering if they were the same who had followed her, one of those faces looked familiar, that of a squat fellow with villainous eyes, she nodded and murmured thanks as she started past. The spear going into her side was such a shock she did not even cry out. Frantically she reached for Sidar, but something else pierced her side and she was down in the dust. That remembered face was thrust into hers, black eyes mocking, growling something she ignored as she tried to reach Sidar, tried to... Darkness closed in.
When Perrin and Fael finally left the interminable interview with her parents, that odd-serving woman Sulin was waiting for them in the hallway. Sweat drenched Perrin, making dark patches on his coat, and he felt as if he had run 10 miles while being pummeled every stride. Fael had a smile on her face and a spring in her step. She looked radiant, beautiful, and as proud of herself as when she brought the Watch Hill men just as the Trollocs were about to overrun Emmons Field. Sulin curtsied every time one of them looked at her, nearly falling over every single time. That leathery face with its scar down her cheek was fixed in an obsequious smile that seemed ready to shatter at a breath. Passing maidens flashed hand talk at one another, and Sulin curtsied to them as well, though grinding her teeth loud enough for Perrin to hear clearly. Even Fael began to eye her warily. Once the woman led them to their rooms, a sitting room and a bedchamber with a canopied bed big enough for 10, and a long marble balcony overlooking a fountained courtyard, she insisted on explaining or showing them everything, even what they could see. Their horses had been stabled and curried, their saddlebags were unpacked and hung in the wardrobe with Perrin's axe belt, most of the scant contents laid in the drawers of a chest-on-chest in a precise array. Perrin's axe was propped beside the gray marble fireplace, as though to chop kindling. One of the two silver pitchers, glistening with condensation, held cool tea, flavored with mint, the other plum punch. Two gilt-framed mirrors on the wall were pointed out and touched, one over a table where Fael's ivory comb and brush were laid, and a great stand mirror with carved uprights that a blind man could not have missed. While Sulin was still explaining about bathwater being brought and copper tubs, Perrin pressed a gold crown into her calloused palm. "Thank you," he said, "but if you will leave us now..." For a moment he thought she was going to throw the fat coin at him, but instead he got another wavering curtsy and a slammed door as she departed.
"I suppose whoever trains the servants doesn't know her job," Fael said. "That was very good, by the way. Polite but firm. If you would only do that with our servants..."
As she turned her slim back, her voice dropped to a murmur.
"Will you unbutton me?"
He always felt very thick-fingered undoing her small buttons, half afraid he was going to pop them off or tear her dress. On the other hand, he did enjoy undressing his wife. She usually had a maid do it, because of lost buttons, he was sure.
"Did you mean any of that nonsense you told your mother?"
"Have you not tamed me, my husband?" she said without looking at him, "and taught me to perch on your wrist when you call? Do I not run to please you? Am I not obedient to your smallest gesture?"
She smelled amused. She certainly sounded amused. The only thing was, she sounded as if she meant it, too. The same as when she told her mother practically the same thing, head high and as proud as she could be. Women were strange, that was all there was to it. And her mother, for that matter, her father. Maybe he could change the subject.
"What was that Bashir had mentioned?"
"Fael, what is the broken crown?"
He was sure that had been it. She made a vexed noise and suddenly began to smell upset.
"Rand is gone from the palace, Perrin."
"And if he is?"
Bending to peer at a tiny mother-of-pearl button, he frowned at her back.
"How do you know?"
"The maidens. Bane and Chia taught me some of their hand talk. Don't let on, Perrin. From the way they behaved when they heard there were Aiel here, I think maybe they shouldn't have. Besides, it might be good to understand what the maidens are saying without them knowing it. They seem thick around Rand."
She twisted around to give him a roguish look and stroke his beard.
"Those first maidens we met thought you have nice shoulders, but they did not think much of this. Aiel women do not know a good beard when they see one."
Shaking his head, he waited until she turned again, then pocketed the button that had come off when she twisted. Maybe she would not notice. He had gone a week with a button missing from his coat, and had not known until she pointed it out. As for beards, from what Gaul said, Aiel always shaved clean. Bane and Chiat had thought his beard a subject for odd jokes. He had thought of shaving himself more than once in this heat, but Fael did like the beard.
"What about Rand? Why should it matter if he's left the palace?"
"Just that you should know what he's doing behind your back. Obviously, you didn't know he was going off. Remember, he is the Dragon Reborn. That is very like a king of kings. And kings sometimes use up even friends. By accident,
and on purpose.
Rand wouldn't do that. What are you suggesting, anyway, that I spy on him? He meant it as a joke, but she said,
Not you, my love. Spying is a wife's work.
Fail!
Straightening so fast he nearly yanked another button loose, he took her shoulders and turned her to face him.
You are not going to spy on Rand, do you hear me?
She put on a dogged look, mouth drawing down, eyes narrowing. She practically reeked of stubbornness, but he could be dogged too.
Fail, I want to see some of that obedience you were boasting about.
As far as he could see, she did what he said, when she good and well pleased, and otherwise not, and forget whether he was in the right or not.
I mean it, Fail. I want your promise. I'll be no part of any...
I promise, my heart, she said, placing her fingers over his mouth. I promise I will not spy on Rand. You see, I am obedient to my lord husband. Do you remember how many grandchildren my mother said she expects?
The sudden change of direction made him blink. But she had promised. That was the important thing.
6, I think. I lost count when she started telling us which were to be boys and which girls.
Lady Deira had had some startlingly frank advice on how this was to be achieved. Thankfully, he had missed most of it, from wondering whether he should leave the room till she finished. Fail had just nodded away, as though it was the most natural thing in the world, with her husband and her father there.
At least 6, she said, with a truly wicked grin. Perrin, she will be looking over our shoulders unless I can tell her she can expect the first soon. And I thought, if you ever managed to undo the rest of my buttons...
After months of marriage, she still blushed, but that grin never faded.
The presence of a real bed after so many weeks makes me forward as a farm girl at harvest.
Sometimes he wondered about these Saldae and farm girls she was always bringing up. Blushes or no blushes, if they were as forward as Fail when he and she were alone, no crops would ever be harvested in Saldaea. He broke off 2 more buttons, getting her dress undone, and she did not mind a bit. She actually managed to tear his shirt.
Demira was surprised to open her eyes, surprised to find herself lying on the bed in her own room in the Crown of Roses. She expected to be dead, not undressed and tucked under a linen sheet. Stevan was sitting on a stool at the foot of her bed, managing to look relieved, concerned, and stern all at the same time. Her slender Kyrian and warder was a head shorter than she and nearly 20 years younger for all the gray streaking his temples, but sometimes he tried to behave like a father, all but claiming she could not take care of herself without him holding her hand. She very much feared this incident would give him the high ground in that struggle for months to come. Mirana was on one side of the bed looking grave, Berenicia on the other. The plump yellow sister always looked grave, but now she looked absolutely somber. How? Demira managed. Light, but she felt weak. Healing did that, but putting her arms outside the sheet was an effort. She must have been very close to death. Healing left no scars, but memories and weakness were quite enough. A man came into the common room, Stevan said, claiming he wanted some ale. He said he had seen Aiel following an Aes Sedai. He described you exactly, and saying they were going to kill her. As soon as he spoke, I felt... He grimaced bleakly. Stevan asked me to come, Berenicia said. He all but dragged me, and we ran the whole way. Truth, I was not certain we were in time until you opened your eyes just now. Of course, Mirana said in a flat voice. It was all part of the same trap, the same warning, the Aiel and the man. A pity we let him get away, but we were so concerned over you that he managed to slip off before anyone thought to hold him. Demira had been thinking about Milam and how this was going to affect the search in the library, about how long it was going to take Stevan to calm down, and what Mirana was saying did not really penetrate until the last. Hold him? A warning? What are you talking about, Marana? Berenicia muttered something about her understanding if they showed it to her in a book. Berenicia had an acid tongue at times. Have you seen anyone come into the common room for a drink since we arrived, Demira? Marana asked patiently. It was true. She had not. One or even two Aes Sedai made little difference to an inn's custom in Camelin, but nine was another matter. Mistress Sinchonin had remarked on it openly of late. Then it was intended you should know Aiel had killed me, or maybe that I was to be found before I died. She had just recalled what that villainous-faced fellow had growled at her. I was told to tell you all to stay away from Althor. Exact words, tell the other witches to stay away from the dragon reborn. I could hardly deliver that message dead, could I? How were my wounds placed? Stevan shifted on his stool, darting a pained look at her. Both missed any organ that would have killed you on the spot, but the amount of blood you lost. What are we to do now? Demira cut in, directing her question to Marana, before he could start in on how foolish she had been to let herself be caught that way. I say we should find the Aiel responsible, Berenicia said firmly, and make an example of them. She came from the border marches of Shinar, and Aiel raids had been a feature of her growing up. Cianid agrees with me. Oh, no, Demira protested. I will not have my first chance to study the Aiel ruined. They'll hardly say two words as it is. It was my blood, after all. Besides, unless the man who gave you warning was Aiel, too, it seems obvious to me that they acted under orders, and I think there is only one man in Camelin who orders Aiel. The rest of us, Marana said, eyeing Berenicia firmly, agree with you, Demira. I want to hear no more talk of wasting time and energy finding one pack of hounds among hundreds, while the man who set them to hunt walks about grinning. Berenicia bristled a little before bowing her head, but she always did. We must at least show Althor he cannot treat Aes Sedai in this fashion, Berenicia said sharply. A glance from Marana moderated her tone, though she did not sound happy. Yet not so sharply that it ruins everything we've planned, of course. Demira steepled her fingers against her lips and sighed. She did feel weak. A thought occurs to me. If we charge him openly with what he's done, he will deny it, of course, and we have no proof to fling in his face. Not only that, it might be wise to let it be learned that he feels free to hunt Aes Sedai like rabbits. Marana and Berenicia exchanged glances and nodded quite firmly. Poor Stevan frowned furiously. He had never let anyone walk away from hurting her. Might it not be better to say nothing? That will certainly make him ponder and sweat. Why haven't we said anything? What are we going to do? I don't know how much we can do, but we can at least make him look over his shoulder. A valid point, Verin said from the doorway. Althor has to respect Aes Sedai, or there will be no working with him. She motioned Stevan to leave. He waited for Demira's nod, of course, then took his stool. I thought since you were the target, she frowned at Marana and Berenicia. Will you sit down? I do not mean to get a crick in my neck staring up at you. Verin went on while they were still placing the room's only chair and a second stool beside the bed. Since you were the target, Demira, you should help decide how Master Althor is to be taught his lesson, and you seem to have made a beginning already. What I think, Marana began, but Verin cut her off. In a moment, Marana. Demira has the right to first suggestions. Demira's breath caught as she waited for the explosion. Marana always seemed to want her decisions approved by Verin, which was natural enough under the circumstances, if awkward, but this was the first time Verin had simply taken charge, in front of others at least. Yet all Marana did was stare at Verin for a moment, lips compressed, and then bow her head. Demira wondered whether this meant Marana was going to resign the embassy to Verin. There did not seem anything else she could do now. All eyes turned to Demira, waiting. Verin's were particularly penetrating. If we want him to worry over what we intend to do, I suggest no one go to the palace today. Perhaps without any explanation, or if that is too strong, with one he must see through. Mirana nodded. More importantly, as things were turning out, Verin did as well. Dimira decided to venture a little more. Maybe we should send no one for several days to let him stew. I'm sure watching Min will tell us when he is nicely on the boil, and... Whatever they decided to do, she wanted to be part of it. It had been her blood, after all, and the light only knew how long she would have to put off her researches in the library now. That last was almost as much a reason to teach Althor his lesson as his forgetting who Aes Sedai were.